A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week, Phil Maughan talks to George Eaton and Raphael Baer about labour, polling and teachers, Caroline Crampton speaks to Sam Azimadu about our Writers of Colour Week, and Kate Mossman tells us everything you need to know about the Coen brothers. From this week, you can also find us on iPad and iPhone.
I'm Philip Maughan, and I'm joined by George Eaton, the editor of the Staggers blog, and Raphael Baer, our political editor, to talk about the week in politics. So, George, you wrote this week about polling and how polling has become a lot more accurate and what this might mean for our projections towards the next election. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, one of the points here is that a lot of people say, in relation to the Labour lead, it's an illusion because it will fade away in advance of the election because people always... are drawn towards the government when they take a another look at the opposition and think, actually, we don't want to put these guys in power. But one reason why Labour's lead was exaggerated in the past was that polling was less accurate, partly because of what sophologists call the shy Tory factor. So this is where people who claim they're going to vote for Labour or Lib Dems, or at least not Tory, then go on to vote Tory in the privacy of the polling booth. And there are now various ways that they account for that. For instance, one pollster, ICM, automatically transfers 50% of those who say don't know to the Tory camp on the basis that past results show that people, a good guide to how people will vote in the next election is how they voted in the last one.
And did America, the last election in America, because there was so much talk around polling and Nate Silver and all of this business, have we learned any lessons from that election?
Well, the lesson Labour has learnt from Obama that I wrote about is that Obama trailed Romney on reducing the deficit and on managing the economy. Now, that would seem to be a weak hand, but crucially, he led him on increasing living standards and whether he'll be good for me and my family. And that's why Labour has made this shift recently, this strategic shift towards focusing on what it calls cost of living issues, energy prices, wages, housing, and trying to pull away the debate from the deficit, debt, austerity, which is territory which feels uncomfortable on because the Tories have defined the debate so well. And they think in the run-up to the election, people are much more likely to ask, how am I feeling? Have my wages increased? Are prices too expensive in the shops? Well, who do I think is going to be able to clear the rest of the central government budget deficit?
Indeed. The interesting thing about that is they are Labour. You talk to people at the top of the Labour Party now, and there's a sense around Ed Miliband's camp that they are very confident about this. And some Labour MPs even say they're getting a bit cocky about it, actually, that they've turned the story on the economy round to fight a battle on their terms for a change.
Is this because it's polling well?
It does. Polls very well. And because they think that the Tories are very disoriented by it because they don't have an answer. The conventional orthodox conservative argument is that you generate growth through essentially supply side measures or you sound money and supply side reform. So you get the budget deficit under control, you get monetary policy under control, you generate growth and the wealth sort of takes care of itself. Now, Ed Miliband's central argument, the sort of the core intellectual proposition of his entire project is that the mechanism by which the wealth created by a growing economy is distributed through the whole of society has broken, that is fundamentally broken, and it isn't happening anymore. So you could get a sort of a joyless recovery. Growth could come back to the economy and not enough people would feel that in their pockets. So that, and the evidence completely supports Miliband on this. The big question is whether politically that is a campaign that you can fight. And going back, I wanted to ask George about this in the polling, because the big question there is, if he's got a good argument and he's got a strong case, and it isn't necessarily cutting through, or they're still only sort of between 3 and 6 points ahead in the polls, is that partly because Ed himself is not the communicator, not the messenger? He's not Barack Obama, no, you know, by a long chalk. And I wonder, is the fact that we know that Miliband's personal communications weakness is a problem for Labour, because you just look at his personal ratings, is that in the price of the Labour poll lead at the moment, or is it something that actually will start to weigh down on Labour when people actually seriously start to think, is that guy, are we going to make that guy Prime Minister? Or is that not what people vote on?
I don't think Labour need to be as worried about Miliband's poor personal ratings as they do about the economy. A lot of people support Labour already in spite of Miliband's, not because of him. And so I think people have already made up their minds about Ed Miliband. So I don't think the Tories pushing hard on that is going to do them any favours. I think the reason the polls have narrowed is because there has been this significant increase in economic optimism. People are starting to think, okay, actually the Tories, the government, yes, they had a bad start, and actually, you know, it was bloody hard clearing up Labour's mess anyway. But the country's moving in the right direction now. Trajectory is all important, and the correlation between the rise in the Tories' poll ratings, or at least the narrowing of Labour's lead, and that rise in economic optimism and the feel-good factor is striking. I think that's what's fueling it.
And so you could easily get to a situation where Labour would say, but you're not feeling it in your pocket, wages haven't gone up, inflation's gone up, the perception of how well off you are in 2015 compared to how you were in 2010 or 2005 would support Labour's argument, and yet people will confidently go, yeah, but actually it is moving in the right direction. Or sorry, the Conservative campaign will be, look, we know, we accept all that, it's hard, but we're moving in the right direction. Will you take a gamble on them, on Labour and on Ed Miliband? And if there is a feeling, which I think there is, that actually there's only so much government can do about this, the sort of powerless, dismal, well, this is just the way it's got to be, make do and mend, get on with it, hope for the best, all of that, which is a deep part of the sort of cultural apparatus of this country, will support the Tories.
Absolutely. I think, to take it back to the US briefly, Romney did run on the Ronald Reagan line that Miliband echoes, which is, are you worse off or better off than you were 4 years ago? And didn't work for him, because Obama could at least say things are moving in the right direction, we'll get there, give me 4 more years to finish the job. And they didn't believe that Romney would do any better. Now, the Tories have similarly said, let us finish the job, but a point one Labour aide made to me recently is that they're talking about the deficit. Obama was talking about living standards. And that's why it was much more salient and struck a chord with voters. And this is why some Tory MPs do recognise that while the Tories are right to reject Miliband's energy price freeze because they do think it would be an ineffective market intervention, they do need some retail offers of their own that people can point to and go, okay, so that's how the Tories will make me better off.
And it ties in particularly in a particularly toxic way with preconceived ideas of whose side the Tories are likely to be on. So if it was just the case of a Conservative Party saying, Christ, this has been difficult, Labour really trashed the place, and guess what, it's taking a bit long, and the Eurozone exploded, so guess what, it's taken a little bit longer than we hoped to sort things out, but it's hard, that would be a perfectly credible, feasible way to run a campaign. If the people who are delivering that message have already been branded in lots of people's eyes as self-serving, greedy, red-faced, port-swilling toffs who give tax cuts to millionaires, it makes it harder. And that, I think, is where that's the difference between the Tories having a campaign that could get them to be the biggest party in the hung parliament, which I think they could do, and having a campaign that could actually get them a majority, which I don't at the moment think they could.
Yeah, projects like turning London Property into a kind of bank, you know, this isn't necessarily going to play particularly well outside, well, even in London, actually. I mean, it's the difference between a graph on the screen that you watch of an evening and actually looking at the little niceties that things like maybe EMA for your kids going to sixth form college that have disappeared and that
yeah, are actually and there's some very interesting polling out, was it today or yesterday, about how effectively the Lib Dems have managed to implant the idea in people's heads that had they not been in coalition, the Tories would, you know, there wouldn't have been any help for people on low incomes, and it would have been, you know, the sort of the Theresa May on steroids approach to.
I think they were pushing that line before government even started. Almost, I remember people saying, "Oh well, maybe hopefully they'll kind of curb some of the slashonomics." One group of people who aren't feeling especially optimistic right now are teachers. Raph, you've written about the teacher strike this week, ongoing as you speak.
I have. Well, today it's a one-day strike. What I've written about really is the sense that the fact that, although, as George is saying, you know, that there are arguments that Labour seems to be winning at the moment on the economy, there are also very strong currents that seem to be the sort of pushing against Labour, in the sense that austerity and recession and austerity combined have not created a great sense of collective solidarity, and they have not, we are not galvanized together in some, you know, in response to the financial crisis in some great mass, you know, objection to capitalism. Actually, what appears to have happened socially and culturally is people have retrenched and they are looking after their own interests, and they are very concerned about, even people on benefits worry that other people on benefits are undeserving, whereas theirs is, of course, the deserving case. You know, the immigration, it's very hard to make a case that actually foreigners coming to this country and working here might be of some benefit to this country, which economically, culturally, socially, generally it is, because we have, you know, we have become more kind of reactionary and, you could say, selfish. The reason that I sort of bring that up in the context of the strike is because a lot of people wouldn't necessarily immediately understand why the teachers are out today. It is to do with their pay and pensions, largely, and their working conditions. Actually, it's part of a broader apparatus of just hating Michael Gove, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for people on the left to do. You know, they lots of people hate Michael Gove, but what it exposes is the way that the conventional arsenal of left solidarity, which is trade unions saying, you know, we stand up for workers' rights, one out, all out, has absolutely no cultural traction in this country. Most people, you know, they like teachers, so they'll shrug their shoulders and put up with it. Some will get angry because they've got to find an extra day of childcare. What they will not do is feel any sense of collective endeavour in protecting one group of people who actually at least are getting some kind of pay rise at all, even if it's not one as big as they would like, and in protecting a pension, which at least they have, unlike lots of people on low incomes in the private sector. And so although Labour are sort of winning individual arguments, there is a massive cultural, collective, moral crisis of the left that Labour hasn't yet addressed, which is that actually, what is a left social democratic project when all the old modes of political solidarity have been hollowed out?
And even though we can't hear the chanting here on the fringe of the City of London, I think we'll have to draw a line under it there. Thanks very much, George and Raph.
Hello, Caroline Crampton here, the New Statesman's web editor. As I hope some of you've already noticed, this week we've been running a special week of blogs on the New Statesman, discussing race and the media and the issues thereon. All sorts of things to do with film and television and politics and EastEnders even, anything you could think of. And we've been doing this in partnership with a website called Media Diversity UK, which some of you may know from Twitter, they're at Writers of Colour. And the reason for doing this is we both want to broaden our own representation of ethnic minorities, but also encourage other people to do the same.
Now, I've spoken to Samantha Azumadu, who is the founder of Media Diversity, and she's told me a little bit about the campaign and what she's trying to achieve. I kicked off by asking her how long she'd been running the campaign for.
I think we launched on the 8th of July with an article in The Guardian. So, not that long.
So 3.5 months. And what would you say is the thing you're proudest of achieving with it so far?
Proudest. There's a couple of things. I guess one, which I mentioned in the article I wrote for you, is that we found an audience, meaning that we're, I think, at today 162,000 views, which is, I think, pretty good for 3.5 months. But also, what's made me proudest is the writers that have sort of joined our collective, for want of a better word. They range from sort of 18 to older, let's say. And they're just really talented, dedicated people, you know, and that's what's been sort of the joy to see develop, because, you know, we started with, you know, one or two people, and it's grown to, I think, now over 60 people who are on our Writers and Experts page. And I know you had an article by Yasin yesterday that you published about EastEnders, and he was one of the first people who sort of found me after I launched the All White Front Pages campaign, and we had to and fro's over email and so on, got to know each other a bit. And he's written for us quite a few times, so it was a real, real proud moment yesterday when he got into the New Statesman after, I think, last year he'd sort of pitched to The Guardian a couple of times and didn't get anything sort of rejection, and I think it's a really proud moment for him, but for all of us as well, because for one, he's very young, only 18, but he's managed to, since he started, go on to a university degree, doing journalism, and he credits some of that to the writing he's done for us. He showed it to the people that were interviewing him, and they're very interested, and even actually, I think, wanted to come to our launch party, which is in November. So those are the things I'm proud of.
That's really good that it's kind of having that kind of effect, as well as a more general awareness one. Because you mentioned there the All White Front Pages campaign. Mm. Am I right in saying that's really how this all got started?
Yeah, absolutely. How it all came together, basically, I'm not sure if you probably do follow him, Nick Sutton. He's a sort of BBC producer, and he's on Twitter. And he, every night, he tweets the front pages of the tabloids and the broadsheets. And me, being a sort of avid Twitter follower and so on, I started noticing that,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There was a sort of similarity, a sameness to the front pages that he was tweeting. Very rarely was there a person who was non-white on it, especially not in advertising. And people say to me, yeah, but you don't want negative stories about, you know, black or Asian or anything, people on the front page. It says, well, that's not the point. I mean, you've got, in London, I think it's 40%, UK-wide, 16% who are sort of non-white is a way to call it, but also people say BME, or BAME, POC, all sorts of acronyms are given to us people who are not white, so it's up to you to self-identify. But anyway, you rarely saw anybody who of colour on the pages, and I'd read an article called The Evening Standard of Whiteness in The Voice newspaper, sort of Britain's biggest black selling newspaper, and a sort of writer come professor had done a sort of simple analysis of of the Evening Standard over a weekend, and all he'd done was count the pictures in it of who, you know, what were their ethnic background, white, black, Asian, whatever. And he found that there was only, I think, 4 pictures of non-white women, and they were all American sort of superstars, you know, singers and whatever. And he came to the conclusion that somehow the Evening Standard were either deliberately or maybe not deliberately whitewashing their paper, because as I said, London, 40% of us here, whether born here or migrated here, whatever, there are 40%, and London would sort of grind to a halt if we all sort of up and left. So why weren't they representing us? And he decided to boycott the newspaper after having done that simple analysis. And basically that stayed with me. And then the pictures Nick was tweeting also stayed with me. And then suddenly the Times had an Asian woman on the front of their newspaper, and it really excited me. I was like, oh my gosh, the Times, the last person I thought would do it. That was during Ascot. Though recently they did have an actor, Ijafor, who's in the film, Half the Yellow Sun, he's going to be in 12 Years of a Slave, on the front of their newspaper. So maybe things are broadening there. But yeah, so the All White Front Pages campaign came out of that. I wrote a little thing. It didn't go viral exactly, but it was very popular. And I thought, well, why not let me start a website? And then The Guardian got in contact, and I thought, right, well, let me write for them, let me get some writers. And I've been in touch with a guy called Dan Davies, who's a sort of analyst and, well, top financial type guy who used to work for The Guardian, and he was very interested in it, sort of disbelieved me at first, but, you know, but then went away and did like an analysis, a sort of statistical probability analysis of All White Front Pages, and he proved my point. Thankfully, I published that as well on the day we launched, because we knew we'd get a lot of sort of backlash, because as quite often people, you can call people racist, but often they just don't want to think about race, and it's called sort of colour blindness or whatever, you know, and that actually can be very negative within a structure of like Britain, where it is predominantly white, because then things get ignored, and then what happens is a structural racism sort of pervades various institutions, and that's from, you know, that can go from the police to education to work to anything. I mean, something I read a while ago is that, you know, even equal opportunities employers will prefer a name that looks typically sort of Anglo or white, I guess, if you want to say, than a name like mine, for instance, Samantha Asomadu. They would, even with the same skills, they would prefer that they will choose the non long syllabled name to my own, and it's a worry. And one of the reasons, I mean, All White Front Pages is a very catchy slogan, you know, but it, behind that there's a lot more thought that's gone into just representation of us people of colour within the media, because of the, you know, if media sort of reflects society and society reflects media, so it's very important that these things are sort of challenged, and it's sort of overdue time, in my opinion.
Yes, so there's obviously an awful lot more to be done, and I know you mentioned you're having this launch in a couple of weeks in November. What's that made of? What's coming next?
Okay, so basically what's happening is, the launch party is a big deal for us, because what we've done is invite the sort of editors, deputy editors, head of comments, and various editors we've worked with over the last few months, because we've now been published in The Telegraph, The Guardian, New Statesman, which was great, and The Independent, you know, so people we've worked with. And what is happening in the meantime, we are building a database under the sort of URL of people.mediadiversified, and in that database is going to be all our writers and experts, because we have experts as well who don't necessarily write for us, but are sort of top of their field. I mean, we've got scientists, you know, a jazz musician who just won the MacArthur Genius Award, you know, but we will have their details in a searchable database, which with their number and email, because I don't feel comfortable putting that on the website, even though their bios are on the website, which media outlets, even yourself, could subscribe to, either quarterly or annually, and then they'll have access to all these people who are sort of experts in their field for writing, TV interviews, and so on. And that night, that launch night, we're going to ask the British media to sign up to diversity, basically. We're not talking charters or quotas, we're just saying make an effort effort. We've made an effort to find all these people. We've had, I think, over 123 articles for now that you can read, and which you can find what you like. If you wanted to republish, just get in contact, anything like that. But these people are there, available, willing, and ready to go onto the airwaves, to go into the papers, and to put their point of view. Because obviously, there's universal experiences, but your upbringing does colour your point of view. And I think it's important that you do have diverse people on the airwaves and so on, because, I mean, great, Radio 4, you get a grilling of whichever businessman or politician, but why shouldn't a non-white person, a black person, an Asian person be grilled as well, equally, you know? So that's what we're doing. We're asking the UK press to sign up to diversity, and I hope they do.
I'm joined by Kate Mossman, our arts editor, who is recently returned from a trip to New York. Kate, you've been to two impressive concerts out in New York.
Two of these sort of very New York style exclusive concerts where the tickets go for at least $200 each, and they're always for some kind of charity benefit, and you don't really get in. But luckily, I managed to squeeze into both.
I was going to say, you're obviously earning too much, Kate. flying out for a one.
Yeah,
one night,
yeah. I went to see a show of music from the Coen Brothers' new film, Inside Llewyn Davis, which isn't out till January, and it was the most ridiculously star-studded bill I've ever seen. Everyone from Carey Mulligan to John Goodman to Joan Baez and Patti Smith, and they all turned out. Marcus Mumford, obviously, and then the other one was Sting performing his new musical about the shipping building in business in Newcastle, with Jimmy Nail on vocals, and that was in a tiny, tiny little room at the Joe Public Theatre, about 150 people, and it was more like a TV recording. It was quite a surreal experience.
Well, both the Coen Brothers and Sting are kind of removed from the subject matter they're trying to expose or put on a platform here. I mean, Sting the shipbuilder, not quite. I'm sure, yeah. Maybe he has family connections, I'm not really sure.
He's from a normal working class background, and he told us the kind of story that you wouldn't be able to get away with telling to a British audience in the same way. He talked about how when he was 6 years old, he was taken out in his Sunday best on a Saturday, because the Queen Mother was coming to town, and her limo sort of rolled up at the end of the street, and often the royals pick out a little child in the audience, obviously, to sort of, you know, focus on.
Kissing babies.
Yeah, and she apparently waved directly at him. And he said at that moment he was filled with the desire to be in that car with that influence, with that money, and he decided then he was going to get out of his street and put himself on the other side. And it didn't exactly get a whoop of applause, but it went down a hell of a lot better than it would have done if he'd said that kind of thing in England. And significantly, he's not doing any of these shows for his new album in England at all. If you look at the world map of Sting, it's covered in little red dots of every single country, and then England is empty, or Britain is empty.
That's really interesting, not least because there is a bit of a revival in interest in both kind of regional folk music and also, shipyard sort of traditions. You know, there's this Songs from the Shipyards, and by the Unthanks. There's also a show, I can't quite remember the name of it, it was at the Barbican recently, and it's all songs that would have been sung on the shipyards.
Oh, really? Yeah, so this is very... He just knows that people would make fun of him if he did it here. I mean, he was on Jules Holland. He's done a few bits of UK press around it. And it was, I mean, it's sort of slightly irritating because he does sing in the Geordie accent, and he does all the voices of all these different people.
That Geordie accent, he's famously tried to distance
himself. Yeah, yeah. And it's, but I don't know, I've got a lot of respect for him. I think he's just, I know that people find him irritating, but I think he's genuinely talented. And he's weirdly honest as well. And he's the only person of his age, he's 61 or 62, who I've heard say that they started to get seriously worried because they couldn't write songs anymore. He said the last 10 years he's been thinking, you know, what on earth's happened to me? Putting out albums of cover versions, and you know, usually when that happens, it's a much trumpeted thing that sort of, you know, they're returning to the music of their youth or their influences, and they're doing these authentic cover versions. And actually, it's usually because they just can't write songs anymore. And so he admitted on stage that he was worried, and that this is his way of being creative now is to sort of do these slightly more theatrical musical theatre sort of project with a theme that's given to him. He's got his theme, he's got his characters, and he's got a team of writers helping him. So he's done something quite ambitious, but not maybe everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah, the new Coen Brothers film, which isn't out until next year in the UK, but has been doing the rounds at the film festivals, it's called Inside Llewyn Davis. Llewyn Davis, loosely based on Dave Van Ronk, is that right? What can you tell us about him?
Well, they've dredged up somebody who didn't become a commercial success, who was an integral part of the Greenwich Village folk scene to the people that lived there and went to those clubs. He was instrumental in bringing blues into folk music. He was a great improviser. He did a lot of quite intricate guitar playing, the kind of stuff that we got used to John Martin doing years and years later. Now, that's a sort of a real part of folk music now, is that bluesy, jazzy influence. Mm. And Van Ronk was on the scene. He was known as the mayor of McDougal Street. And he was sort of in line to be in Peter, Paul and Mary, but he was apparently deemed too idiosyncratic. And it's a really subtle film because it's about that point just before Bob Dylan, just before Paul Simon and Peter, Paul and Mary, where you weren't expected necessarily to make folk songs your own yet. You were reproducing them beautifully, doing wonderful things on stage, but you weren't necessarily required to have a character. And he's very much a slightly ahead of his time. He's an angry young man. He's sort of a real pain in the neck, actually. And you don't particularly warm to him in the film. You just follow him on this chaos of destruction around New York and all the people he's alienated and all the parties he breaks up and stuff. But you are left feeling very sad.
Is he deemed to be instrumental to the folk revival, though? I mean, despite his character.
He is in the real world, yeah. Right. Because the Coens are so cryptic about this kind of thing, if you ask the Coens directly, is he based on Dave Van Ronk, they will say, oh, only very loosely. But Dave Van Ronk's album was called Inside Dave Van Ronk.
Yeah.
This is called Inside Llewyn Davis. Many of the things that happened to him in the film happened to the real Dave Van Ronk as well. So I think they're playing with the idea of somebody who slipped through the net. And it has this remarkable scene at the end, which I won't spoil, when you realise just how close he was to possibly becoming famous in their eyes, that somebody else gets there. So it's very sad. I mean, I found it very gloomy, quite a depressing experience. It's got a couple of really good comic moments in it, but it's basically about a guy who's on the verge of, you know, throwing himself off the George Washington Bridge or something, like his partner did. He had a harmony partner in the film who had committed suicide, and the spectre of this guy was sort of following around. Every single person who is advising Llewyn on his career says, I think you should get in a duo again. It's like, the guy's dead. That's not a really good thing to hear, you know.
And who else contributed to the show and kind of what did they say as they were doing it?
The show itself was really long, almost too long, 37 tracks. And John Goodman was comparing, and it was very sort of funny.
He is really into music, though, isn't
yes,
he, John
Goodman? Yes, and yet I sort of spoke to him the other day, and a bit like the Coens, he won't be pinned down too much on what sort of music he's into. He's very sort of moody, and he'll suddenly go off on one about the trad jazz that he likes.
Yeah, I thought it was jazz.
It is, yes, and because he lives in New Orleans, so I imagine that he knows Dr. John very well. His role is plays this brilliant role. It's the sort of the real moment of this film for me. He plays a guy called Roland Turner, who's a fictional jazz musician who's modelled on Doc Pomus, Jerry Mulligan and Dr. John, and he's just vile. It's the most vile thing I've ever seen him do, and he doesn't play any music. He's in a car for about 10 minutes of the whole film. And that's it. And he's really, really funny. So he was comparing. And then, all those bands like the Punch Brothers and the Avett Brothers, these brilliant, sort of perfect old-time young bands that you have in America doing quite complex kind of bluegrass and bluegrass country folk music. They were all there. They sort of became the backing bands in a way for Star Turns by people like Joan Baez and Patti Smith and... you remember in a Man of Constant Sorrow in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So that's there is an equivalent in this movie, which is a ridiculous song called Please, Mr. Kennedy, which was written about the space race. And it's sung by Justin Timberlake, who's in the film, as one of the sort of clean-cut folk characters who's going into a commercial career. And it also features that guy who plays Adam in Girls. Basically doing a really odd yodel in the background, and it's a perfect little piece of novelty comic writing, and the irony is that you know that is going to be the hit that comes out within the film. That's the hit. And Llewyn Davis is so desperate for some money at that moment that he's actually signed away his rights to royalties just so he can get $200 to go and, you know,
get and now we're food. There's going to be a universal soundtrack and whatever else, so it's come full circle. Anyway, thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, produced by the New Statesman team. Find more at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.